area, it's outside of the living quarters, and it also is not using up the volume of the living quarters. To your knowledge, is that part of the philosophy of putting all these tanks on the outside for safety reasons as well as saving space? H2N, K2LIW.
Tremendous amount of heat is generated inside the space station, so you've got these gigantic, I'd say, radiators all over the space station. And they're deployed, they almost look like solar cells, and there's piping going to every one of them. And they use ammonia, and ammonia pumps are on the outside. Remember, not too long ago they had an ammonia pump failure that had to be replaced by one of the spacewalks. And these are big, you know, 400-pound things, you know, bolted outside on the truss work. So it was a good design, you know. If you have an ammonia leak inside the space station, you don't want that. If you ever get a whiff of that, boy, it feels like somebody took a nail and rubbed it up your nose. I've come into that problem. Worked, you know, on welding ammonia lines together, and one of the valves was slightly open as we're testing it. Boy, that's not a good feeling. You wouldn't want that inside the space station. And yeah, it makes it nice to go from one end to the other. The problem is, you know, every time you need to redo something, you need a spacewalk.
I presume the ammonia is the cooling fluid that's used for the heat exchanger air conditioning system. Is that what's going on, Paul?
Yeah, they've got a millionaire heat exchangers. Accumulators all throughout the space station, picking up the heat from all the electronics, even the body heat, and that's it. You know, it'll go to a heat exchanger, and then the heat exchanger will have the ammonia in it, and that's all piped to the outside.
There's a zillion square meters of solar panels on the International Space Station. In fact, when you take a photograph of it from the ground, an awful lot of what you see are those solar panels. You've told us once before, do you remember the approximate number of watts of electrical energy being generated by those solar panels? And think about the fact that all of those watts of solar collected electrical energy goes into running various things on the space station, and in theory, except for a little bit of mechanical motion once in a while, almost all of that eventually gets converted to heat. So all of that solar energy collected by those solar panels, converted into electrical energy at, let me pick a number, 20% efficiency, all of that eventual electrical energy has to be dumped by the heat exchangers. It's quite a process. Do you remember roughly how many watts of electrical energy it can generate, Paul, for the S2N, K2LIW?
I should look this up. I should have it memorized, but 36,000 watts per panel set, I think it is, so four times that amount. Might be wrong on that. Enough to run 40 houses, let's put it that way. Each house is 4,000 watts. So, I think it's something like that. Panels themselves, each panel that you're looking at is 200 feet long by 40 feet wide. And then you've got two panels per set, four sets, eight panels. It's a, you know, huge deal, and then you've got on the truss segments, the building of the space station has 11 trusses connected to one another. You've got five on the port side, five on the starboard side, and you've got the one in the middle. And the, I think around S5 or P5, and P5, the, you know, the S for starboard, P for port, you've got the strike, what is it, the spinning joints, which actually turns the panels. So these 200 by 40 foot panel sets at the end are being turned, and once every 90 minutes, so that coincides with the orbital timing of the space station. So this way the panels are always facing towards the sun, plus they're able to augment to it. Twist a little, you know, to the side. The way you always have the panels facing directly into the sun. operation there.
In the very early days when the International Space Station was being proposed and constructed, how long it was going to be used and left in orbit, in the very beginning, I think they had very small, pessimistic numbers, going to use it for 10 years and then abandon it or whatever. You and I are hearing the sounds of a lot of hardware has been put into space at a pretty big expense. What's your best guess right now, Paul, how many more years we think we're going to be using it? And I bet you that number has expanded a number of times. WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, after it was all built, it was supposed to last 15 years, and then that was going to be it. So it was built, finished really last year. So, I mean, based on that theory, you got another 15 years from now. They'll keep it going. It's going to be... the same with me. That thing was supposed to last for like 5 years, 8 years or something. That thing went 15 or more years, you know, for the Russians. So this thing was built... originally, you know, if you look at it, you've got the truss going out one side, and then perpendicular to that, you've got all these different modules going down, you know, perpendicular to the main truss, and you've got 10 different living environments and different main modules that you could be in. And I think they said the inside is equivalent to being inside, you know, the volume inside of a 2747. And it was originally supposed to be double that. If you look at the original Freedom design, remember Reagan, he was going to call it the Freedom. I don't want to time out. There was going to be two sets of modules going down. You're going to have one on the port side, one on the starboard side. And, but they cut back on that design. But yeah, it's still a lot. You know, you've got the Destiny module. You've got the... the Russian Bezda unit, that's where they live in, and then you've got the functioning cargo block. That was the first one that was put up by the Russians, and that's like the machine room. Then you've got one module after the other. You've got the Columbia module that was put up by the European Space Station. You've got the Kaibo, two of the big modules. They're actually the biggest ones that are up there attached to the space station. By Japan, you've got the Quest Lab for going in and out of the space station. The Russians have a similar thing for their, not the Quest Lab, Quest airlock. And the Russians have a similar thing like that. One module after the other. Interconnecting modules, the nodes, you've got Harmony, you've got Unity, six-sided structures, and their main purpose is just to attach everything from the cupola that they look out, and they look down at the Earth, big 3-foot window that they're looking at, plus 7 windows, trapezoid windows surrounding that, that's attached to one of the to Harmony mode module. Big structure. You go on a tour on the internet, and you can go from one end to the other, and an astronaut will walk you through, and you put in a video tour of the inside of the International Space Station. There's a couple of them out there, and they'll take you through from one end to the other. And then you pop out at the end, and you're not done yet. You've got a Soyuz spacecraft you can go into, and one time you had a shuttle I was attached to, you could go into. You've had 13 people on board at one time. It's a big place up there. Big as a football field. If you lay out a football field and then you put the space station on top, it'll fit pretty good.
Very impressive. The space station, International Space Station, is experiencing a very small but continuous nagging amount of air drag, even though it's well above the atmosphere. I mean, those particles of air don't completely stop at some altitude. It's experiencing a small amount of continuous drag. Therefore, many of these launches of astronauts and hardware happen to be accompanied by a little bit of boosting takes place. In other words, you take that craft that is just docked Dragon done that yet? Dragon, Falcon, whatever. Have they done any boosting like that there, Paul? And roughly how often does that boosting have to take place? I am guessing at least once every 6 months. WS2N, K2LIW.
The Dragon, last time it went up, I didn't hear that it did that. Being a demonstration flight, probably not. But they all have that capability. Maybe Dragon won't be one of those, because that needs the fuel to maneuver and get back, especially when it's going to be needed to bring people back. It is bringing cargo back. Probably not. The other ones that are discarded, all the Progress ships, there's been probably 50, 60 of those things that have gone up by the Russians. They all do it. Before they leave, they'll, whatever fuel they have on board, they'll use that to help boost the space station up higher. Definitely the ATV, the European Space Agency automatic transit vehicle. That's a very big spacecraft. It's three times larger than the Progress. That does it. That brings it up. And the H-2 by Japan, again, that burns up over the Pacific on the way back. It probably has the capability, whether that's done that or not, I don't know. And, of course, the space shuttle used to do it all the time. And the International Space Station does have fuel on board, and they could boost itself if they need to. And they've had to use their thrusters to move out of the way of things in space, that way. There's plenty of stuff that goes up there that does help boost that space station. It's a rarefied atmosphere, but there are molecules hitting the space station, like you said, slowing things down. So, left to its own devices. If this thing was going around the moon, let me drop it. Probably never have to do anything. There's no atmosphere. There's no nothing to contend with. There's no ionosphere that's expanding due to the coronal mass ejections. You know, so you don't have any problems like you have here with the ionosphere is expanding. You have more gas up there slowing things down that's in orbit. So, if it was in geosynchronous orbit, you wouldn't have that much of a problem either. But, you know, being close to really a relatively close to the Earth for an orbiting thing, it does have that problem of drag there.
We got that huge rotary joint on the solar panels, so that as the space shuttle, as the International Space Station, can keep having one face aimed toward the Earth as it goes around the Earth once every 90 minutes, and these rotary joints allow the solar panels, photovoltaics, to always aim to the sun. The other approach would have been to always aim the International Space Station in the same direction and let the Earth rotate from under it, if you know what I mean. The disadvantage of that, of course, is any photography on board that wants to take a picture of the Earth would appear to be continuously moving around you once every 90 minutes. So you could either keep the space station in what would I call it now? Inertial reference, fixed position, or let it rotate always facing the Earth and rotate the rotary joints. And there's pros and cons. Have they ever discussed using the other approach during the time the rotary joints are giving them grief? Over to you, Paul. WS2N, K2LIW.
Orbit, that would be a different inclination. Is that what you're talking about there?
Space station always has one face aiming toward the Earth, which means that the International Space Station is rotating 360 degrees every 90 minutes. If you rotate it 0 degrees every 90 minutes, now you wouldn't need a rotary joint on the International and on the space on the photovoltaics. The whole thing could you could call it sun synchronous, but that's not what I really mean. Sun synchronous has got another name. That's a particular kind of orbit. I'm not talking about changing the orbit. I'm talking about the orientation of the International Space Station. You could leave it in a fixed position compared to the fixed stars. It's always aimed the same way. And you wouldn't need a rotary joint. So I'm asking, to your knowledge, have they ever discussed using that mode of operation? operation of the International Space Station, stop it from rotating, in other words, when the rotary joints are giving them grief. And a slightly aligned question, it would take thrusting to do that. You know, a lot of thrusting to stop it from rotating. And by the same token, the thrusting you got on board, is there enough thrusting in a pinch to keep you at the same altitude despite atmospheric drag? WS2N, K2LIW?
I mean, when they look out their windows, like the cupola is designed looking straight down the deer point, and then the zenith is, you know, the other part is looking up. Let me think. If you were to lay out all these different cylinders, yeah, that would be running parallel to the surface of the Earth with the cupola. That's the one, you know, the area with the windows looking down at the Earth. That's the way it's designed. That means that would be rotating at some rate of speed. I don't know if that would be rotating once every 90 minutes. Do that. You know, right now the solar voltaics are rotating every hour and a half to match the orbit. I could see maybe once a day, once every 24 hours, people on board, maybe they could get used to that, but to see that Earth turn below them every 90 minutes, that would be, I think, a little disconcerting for people in orbit there, so probably not. That's okay for something with nobody on board. I mean, people need some kind of a reference. So they could probably do it that way. But I don't think they want to, you know, they want a design where you know, you're going to be comfortable living in it. Even the inside is painted a certain way. Let me drop it. Little panels that they have. There's a difference between the panels on the ceiling and the floor to give the people a sense of, you know, up and down. If it's designed the way it is, it's probably because of human occupancy on board. My guess, Dick. What's interesting is the radiators turn too. All the, you know, solar panels are facing toward the sun. The radiators they have designed to face edgewise to the sun, so they give off the maximum heat. A lot of things to consider when you're going to turn that whole space station.
Yeah, you brought up a very good point. For human orientation reasons, have the bottom of the space station always aimed at the Earth, the cupola always aimed at the Earth, so to speak, or the other way around. And on top of that, not counting the solar panels, the space station itself is moving in an edgewise manner, presents the minimum wind resistance, so to speak, as another advantage. The thrusting on board, can allow you to do orientation if you want to tilt the thing a little bit. But can they do, is there enough thrusting on board that temporarily, if in a pinch, could keep them into the current orbit? In other words, the orbit is slowly decaying. Do they have enough thrusting to boost them to a higher orbit once in a while if they had to? That's my last question. Over to you, Paul. K2LIW.
Yeah, and they have. They've done that. When the Columbia blew up, after that, they relied on the space station to boost themselves up. They weren't getting as many flights after that from the shuttles. They stopped that for a couple of years. So they would refuel using the Russian spacecraft, and plus the Russian spacecraft would boost them up, and they'd have fuel on board to keep them. You know, they would go up like 2 miles instead of the standard 14 miles that the shuttle would do. So that's pretty much it. And the inclination that they picked is all based on the Russians. You know, the Russians didn't have a launch facility down near the equator. If they did, this whole thing would probably be in an equatorial orbit, 51.5 degree deal by, you know, picked by the Russians, because that's where the launch facilities was decided decades ago with the Mir. That was their capability, so we matched them. And that's another reason, by the way, the Dragon spacecraft, the reason that's going to go off of California, I meant to tell you before, is because of the orbit. You know, anything that goes into what I call a polar orbit, launched from Vandenberg on a regular basis, you can get more of a polar orbit from
inclined orbit has another advantage, Paul. Wait long enough, and you're going to see almost the whole Earth. If we had an equatorial orbit, you would only see the land under the equator, you know, 80 miles to the north and 80 miles to the south of that, and an awful lot of that is over water. So I don't see any great advantage of an equatorial orbit. You don't get a chance to see the rest of the world, if you know what I mean. Back to you, Paul.
And nowadays, maybe it's less expensive, but fuel used to be a big thing. You had that 1,000-mile-an-hour push on any equatorial flight, and here you only got, I think, 700-mile push, so you're missing 300-mile free push for, you know, millions of pounds of hardware in space. So, you know, cost-wise, it's cheaper to put things into equatorial orbit. That's the only reason they would have done that.
If you had an equatorial launch location, like what's the name of the place now in South America that the Europeans use, but if you've got a launch from a place that's 30 degrees north of the equator, that's where Florida is, then it takes you extra fuel to get down to that equatorial orbit and then at the equatorial orbit. It actually takes less fuel, as I see it, Paul, to launch at an inclination than to launch at zero inclination. That would take more fuel, Paul, if you're not launching from the right place. How about you, Paul?
Yeah, well, Florida is, what, 22 degrees or 24 degrees or something off the equator. Pretty close. You're thinking of the French Guiana, Kourou, that's even closer to the equator. You've got private companies like Pegasus. They go to the equator. They launch from Kwajalein Island and all of that. But, let's put it this way. If we took an equatorial stance on this thing, the Russians wouldn't have been able to be partners. So it had to be this way, whether or not we wanted to do it, you know, on that particular, inclination or not. But I agree, yeah, you're going to see plenty of land. You might miss the North Pole and the South Pole a little bit, but even that, you probably see it pretty good.
I thank you, Paul. You gave us a lot of information tonight. I learned a lot. Looking forward to next week. John, I think you had a third... John... What is that used for, and why does it have two ports?
Back to you, Dick.
This should be an easy one.
Now, from my point of view, Paul, he bought a very valuable machine. A directional coupler takes a small sample of the signal that's flowing in one direction only. Believe it or not, each one of the ports that are the directional coupled ports, there's really a parallel conductor inside, if it's a coaxial type, TEM type. There's a parallel conductor alongside of the main line going through the center of the thing, which samples some of that signal. One end goes to your output connector. The other end usually has an internal 50-ohm termination. So the signal that flows in the right direction comes out your connector. The signal that flows in the wrong direction goes to that internal termination. So that's one single directional coupler. Build two of those coupling structures in there, one in the north-south direction, one in the south-north direction. Now you can sample the signal independently going in both directions. Let me drop. You set one of those up on a transmitter, for instance. The forward coupled port will give you a sample of how much power is coming out of the transmitter and going into the transmission line. So if it was a 20 decibel coupler, and you're running 100 watts, 120 dB down from 100 watts would be 1 watt, you would get 1 watt out of the sampling port telling you that 100 watts is going from the transmitter up the antenna. The other directional coupler, the fourth port, will tell you what is coming back down from the antenna toward the transmitter. So if the antenna gets disconnected or something fails in the antenna and you have some standing wave ratio, that's a fancy way of saying reflected power ratio, any reflected power from the antenna comes back down the cable and that fourth port samples that. So with this fourth port coupler, you could be using very little loss of the transmission system. Just want to stop doing it. Goodbye. My synthesizer in this rig every so often goes a little bit haywire. That's where you hear the hissing sound in the background. Anyhow, you put this four-port coupler into your transmission system. You now can really measure the integrity of the whole system. You know how much power is coming out of the transmitter. You know how much signal is being reflected from the antenna. That tells you almost everything you want to know. And if you go one step beyond that, properly calibrating that dual directional coupler, four-port directional coupler, would allow you to generate a poor man's vector network analyzer, and I'm not kidding. So I don't care if that guy paid $200 for that coupler or less, he got a bargain. As long as it covers in the vicinity of the frequency range he wants, sir. But even that is not a restriction. If he bought a directional coupler that's made for, let me pick a number, 1 to 2 gigahertz, there's nothing stopping him from using it at 144 megahertz and 50 megahertz, for instance. It'll require a little bit of additional calibration or calculation, but at lower frequencies, it also works very well. And a well-kept secret, directional couplers work all the way down to DC. They just change the coupling coefficient. And so he could, if he wants to, downrange, make a poor man's vector network analyzer out of that ball. That's a valuable machine that most guys at a flea market look at it and say, I don't need that. WS2N, K2RIW. Here we go. KC2WGV, K2RIW.
KC2WGV. Yeah, Dick, well, he paid $12 for it. So, and it's a Narda. It looks like a good one. But that is very interesting, and I'm sure he could use that information to, I don't know if he has an analyzer that he could turn into a vector network analyzer, but it would be interesting to see that happen. Very good. Well, that's it from Mel's Corner. And go on with your conversation about the antenna thing.
Yeah, you said if he has an analyzer, a spectrum analyzer is one approach, a dual-channel oscilloscope that goes high enough in frequency, connected to those two ports. When you interpret the signal on the screen of a oscilloscope, you are looking at amplitude in voltage, not dBm, but that's a simple conversion. And depending on how you synchronize the oscilloscope, you are getting phase information. You've been starting to do phase measurements on your oscilloscope, John. Once you get amplitude and phase off those two ports, even with something as simple as an oscilloscope, properly used, that is a poor man's vector network analyzer. That's what a vector network analyzer does. It measures amplitude and phase of what goes out, amplitude and phase of what comes back, or amplitude and phase of what gets to the other port, if it's a throughput measurement, and that's everything you want to know. So, a crafty guy with a high-frequency oscilloscope and that dual-directional coupler, that four-port coupler, he could use that as a vector network analyzer. Do you see where I'm going with that one, John? You're doing a backup vector network analyzer with the oscilloscope phase measurements you're starting to make. KC2WGB, KQLIW.
I think I'm going to have to try that out with a four-port directional coupler and see how that works out. My scope only goes to 500 meg, both of them, but that's well within the band that I'm working. It's a great idea. Back to you, Dick.
And what's very interesting is that since voltage squared gives you power, and power we usually convert to dBm, when we're or dB when we're making VNA measurements, since the oscilloscope measures voltage, as the signal gets weaker and weaker, the power in watts goes down real fast because it's voltage squared. You could say the voltage goes down very slowly. So measuring weak signals on an oscilloscope is a heck of a lot easier than you think. There's a lot more watts or amplitude decibels of dynamic range on that screen than you think. And if you're willing to put a preamplifier in between that you turn on and turn off at the right time, you could measure some very weak signals coming out of those directional couplers going into that oscilloscope. So in the old days, making phase measurements used to be considered black magic, very difficult, and so on. Once we got past the mental block of making phase measurements, and that's what the very first, the Hewlett-Packard machine that measures signals and phase, vector voltmeter. The vector voltmeter, which I think came before the vector network analyzer, the vector voltmeter, and I own one of those, and it goes from 1 meg to either 1,000, I think it goes from 1 meg to 1,000 megs. Let me drop. That really is, when hooked up to a directional coupler, measures amplitude and phase, everything you want to know. That vector voltmeter will measure phase to the nearest 1 degree. I will admit that measuring phase off the screen of an oscilloscope to get 5 or 10 degrees of accuracy is about the best you're going to do to try to figure out the horizontal displacement of a sine wave, the zero crossing point, to the nearest fraction of a millimeter is a bit difficult. So measuring phase very accurately off an oscilloscope is kind of difficult. But that vector voltmeter, of all the machines you own, I wonder if you own a Hewlett-Packard vector voltmeter, and I wish I could think of the model number of that darn thing. Over to you, John. KQRIW.
Yes, I do, Dick. Although I do not have the probes for it. They had very special probes which were fixed. They were not something you could unplug, and both of them got crushed. So it's not working at this time. I don't remember the model number either. I know it wasn't a 229, but it was something like that.
Yeah, I wish I could remember the name, the number of that. And those probes, I don't know if the sampling, the diode sampling, took place in the probe or inside. I think it took place inside, yes. What the machine does, if you study that, the vector voltmeter, John, it takes every input signal between roughly 1 meg and 1,000 megs. You turn the dial on the front panel to the right frequency region, and then it would phase lock to it. And what it would do is it literally took every signal coming into those probes and superheterodyne beat it down to 60 kilohertz. The IF strip inside that machine is 60 kilohertz. It makes all of its phase and amplitude measurements at 60 kilohertz. So those probes are fairly elaborate. Electronically, there's nothing there. I think they're a very simple coaxial cable, those probes. The only thing that makes the probes elaborate is they had a fancy connector on the output end of them so that they could be plugged into the specially made Hewlett-Packard four-port directional coupler. So that's the only thing those probes do. It's got a funny connector that can be plugged into that coupler, and you could also put an adapter on the end of them so that you could adapt them to BNC and type N, so to speak, and APC. So I think those probes are nothing more than a coaxial cable. That's not a showstopper, John. And as I said, since everything measured inside is done at 60 kilohertz, all of the sampling, phase measuring, and whatever is done at 60 kilohertz. Over to you, John, KQLIW.
C2 goes to QV. Oh, that's good news, Dick. I know they had a diode set up in there. I know they had replaceable tips, and you're right, you could thread, they were a special light, sort of like an F connector, that would convert to BNCs. I've seen those. But, yeah, well, that's good. Maybe I can just find out what that type of wire. There's nothing marked on the wire, but I could probably get some coaxial wire to replace that. Maybe the 174 might do it.
You said the probes, the ends of the probes in your case are crushed. You're a pretty smart guy with sheet metal work and whatever. Is that there's some possibility, John, that you could uncrush the probes? In other words, somebody did the equivalent of squeezing the end with a pair of pliers. If you did some really fancy metal work under an oscilloscope, could you straighten out the crushed areas of those probes? Back to you, John.
No, Dick, these angle iron hit them right in the center and bent them like into an L, so they were destroyed totally. And I threw out the ends of them. I didn't look inside to see if there was any electronics in there. I just figured I'd buy two new probes, but they're just both come back.
Yeah, those probes are going to be as rare as hen's teeth. That vector voltmeter itself was not a popular machine. People didn't understand it. And therefore, there's very few of those on the surplus market, and therefore the probes are going to be even rarer. And even if those probes exist in the warehouse at Hewlett-Packard, I'm a little bit afraid they're going to cost you a fortune. Out of curiosity, have you looked up the replacement price of those probes, Paul? Go ahead.
Yes, Dick, I looked them up. They were around $300 each, I believe. Not available, not even from HP, and I have a friend of mine who used to work for them, and he doesn't have any either. But interesting thing is there are ones on eBay occasionally that do have good probes on them, and they sell for about $200, not working, of course, but the probes look like they're in decent shape. So I was thinking maybe do that, just remove those probes and put them on mine.
Yeah, the next time you see a Victor voltmeter Hewlett-Packard on eBay, I recommend you buy it for those kind of prices. Just the price of the probes makes it worth it. On top of that, even if the machine is non-working, John, when you study the schematic diagram, if you've got the service manual or the owner's manual on that thing, it's not that elaborate. There isn't gold-plated and what's the word for it here? Well, we're not talking about exotic hardware inside. I think there's a 90% chance if you buy one non-working, you could make it work if you wanted to. The only thing that would be hard to replace in there is the main power transformer. And there's lots of ways you could find a substitute for that. So I think you're way ahead of the game to buy a non-working used one on eBay. How long ago did you last see one of those on eBay, John? K2LIW?
About 2 weeks ago, there were three of them on there for sale. And they were, all of them were under $500. One was like three and change. And all three of them were listed as non-working. So you may be right. Maybe something to look at.
There were three of them on eBay. Have they already sold? And is there a way you can find out what price they sold for, John?
Yeah, I can find out what they sold for. I don't know if they're still on there. I haven't looked for one in a couple of weeks. That was the last time I looked. But I will check those tomorrow and see if they're still available. As long as they have decent probes on them, I can take it, because with the two machines, no matter what it is, I can probably fix it with no problem.
Even if you only owned one of them, I think there's a 90% chance you buy a non-working one, you can make it work. The worst that somebody could do is either have a blown transformer, blown power supply, And I'm not sure if the sampling diodes in there could be, yes, the mixer. There's a down-converting mixer that takes all of your 1 to 1,000 megacycles, mixes it down to 60 kilohertz. And if you buy that mixer directly from Hewlett-Packard, it's going to be expensive. There's nothing that exotic about that mixer. It's a nicely built, doubly balanced mixer. And yes, the mixer you're going to put in there instead is going to have a slight different phase characteristic. But for sweeping in frequency, it will not track in phase. But you're willing to recalibrate the phase for each new frequency you go to. Therefore, you don't need the super elaborate mixer. Any old doubly balanced mixer that covers those frequency regions will do it for you, John. I think you, of all the things that you've bought and not bought, I think you're onto something on this one, John. Go ahead.
I like the machine. I haven't used it much. I was playing with it without the probes working, just to see, to get an idea how this thing worked. And because I didn't remember, it was so many years ago that I was using it. And I know it's still a good machine. I really don't want to throw it out. Even though I have a VNA now, I really don't need the machine. But it would be something to refurbish and have here and to learn how to use it again.
Yeah, it has a so-called reference port and a measurement port. The reference port, you have to give it a signal a little bit on the strong side, something like minus 10 dBm or 0 dBm. It phase locks itself to that reference signal that you plug in. Then it measures the comparison between that signal and the signal you want to measure, which has been through some unknown device. And that unknown device has got an insertion loss and a phase shift. And I think the thing has at least 60 decibels of dynamic range, if not more, maybe even 80. You've got a dial that you adjust to keep the dynamic range within of the signal, the unknown signal you're measuring. And it's got another set of dials where you can decide that the phase measurement will be plus or minus 180, plus or minus 90. I think it goes down all the way to plus or minus 6 degrees in the most sensitive position. I think you can measure phase on that machine in the plus or minus 6 degree mode to a fraction of 1 degree. So that's a fun machine, John. And you've got to have one of those in working order. The number of measurements you can make with that, I mean, then you can take those two signals out of your so-called resistive power divider, which I'm now convinced is not resistive, that were going into the two channels of your oscilloscope. You can now plug those two signals into your, into your vector network analyzer, let it measure the amplitude difference and phase difference, and see if the phase difference, the V vector network, the vector voltmeter gives you the same apparent phase shift as you're getting off the screen of the oscilloscope. And that would be kind of fun. I'm slowly beginning to think that since you've got 0 degrees of 0 decibels of insertion loss of your so-called resistive power divider, I'm convinced it's not resistive, and it possibly was making the phase shift you're measuring. You may have gotten confused when you think you switched the two ports coming out of the power divider going into the cables, whether or not the effect followed the which channel of the oscilloscope moved. I think that test should be repeated, John. You may have really been shifting the phase right at your resistive power divider. KC2WGB, K2LIW.
KC2WGB. Well, I will reinstitute that test, and I'll take notes to make sure I don't make any mistakes. And I'm also going to check the dB to make sure I read that right when it was 3 dB down. Maybe I made a mistake and it's 6 dB down. That's not much motion on the spectrum analyzer. You know, it's only a little more than half of the distance between the centimeter marks. So put a bit of an error there too, especially with my eyes. But, yeah, give me a couple of projects to do, right? Back to you, Nick.
Very fine, John. Stand by while I run a test again. Hello, 1, 2, 3, 4. Okay, for the time being, it looks like this is working, and if it keeps working, I'll continue. continue this way for a little while, because I think I get a little bit cleaner audio by this approach. To get into this discussion that started a couple of weeks ago, what does a radio wave really look like? What does the magnetic field look like coming off the antenna? What does the E field look like? We know that for a fact that a signal that's far out in space, that's been a long distance away from the source of signal, it is a planar wave. It starts off a spherical wave real close to the antenna, but far away that wave becomes a planar wave when you're far enough away from the source. The signal, in the past I've said that it has a lot of characteristics like beads on a string. I'm hearing some signals in the background there. Somebody's attempting to do something. The beads on the string fits one of the characteristics, and that is every scientific area you want to discover really has a model that goes along with it. Your real smart guys at the beginning of the 20th century were studying what atoms look like, what molecules and atoms look like. And you had people like Rutherford and Thomson and Dirac and all these smart guys slowly coming up with a model of what does a molecule look like. And their model was a little bit like a solar system. It had a nucleus in the center where the protons and neutrons, they eventually discovered, were located. And you had this cloud of electrons around that nucleus. And the simple model they draw looks like a miniature solar system where all of the electrons are in one orbit. The plane, they're all...
Repeater, time out, cancel.
Vic, go ahead.
I mean, I interrupt you, but I just was wanting to get you straight on something. In radio, when we talk about DF, what does Delta Foxtrot usually stand for?
Sorry about that, sir. Okay, I'll go to the other mode.
And for you, John, when you're asked to turn your power down, you really shouldn't need to announce it to let some other folks know that you're doing that. And the reason for that was to leave enough signal to do some DFing.
Understood. Sorry about that.
We're slowly getting smarter, Eric.
I'm sorry you had to put up with that stuff, but we had a clue doing some stuff out there, and it was a good opportunity. I mean, I could have killed it right away, but I wanted to give him an opportunity. So, you took the front end of it. By the way, the normal input is not turned on. These alternate inputs, actually, on the past two TechNet, the voting system, because it works on the signal noise ratio, it requires very little interaction from anybody because you guys, you'll hit a receiver and have a nice clean input, whereas the interfering signals, even with the modulation that they were creating, created a lot of noise and the voters basically ignored it.
Good to know.